really commend your lesson, Doug. I thought it was really good. On the things about the book of Exodus that portray things in Christianity, you gave a long list and recognized that that wasn't all of them. But one of the things I thought about is that actually the whole plan of our salvation is there in the book of Exodus. You see, God had to choose a deliverer for them, just like he has to choose one for us. Then their first job was to believe in that deliverer. Moses was worried that they wouldn't believe, but God said, "They'll believe. I'll give you miracles to perform to make them believe," just like John said Jesus did. Then they had to confess their belief in Moses, and Moses got before Pharaoh. God said, "You take the elders of the children with you to Pharaoh." And so they had to go and say, "Yes, he's right. We believe in Moses and he's God." Then they had to turn their back on the brick hills of Egypt. And that's a definition of repentance. And then they had to be baptized. It's all there. As well as the worship that began. Incidentally, the basic principle of all worship, Moses laid down in chapter 13 when he said, "You've got to do God's things at God's time in God's way."
The order of Israel's deliverance, like you say, it's the same order we have as Christians. For example, there's bondage, there's deliverance, there's wandering, and then they reach the promised land. And you look at us as Christians, first of all, there's deliverance through our obedience to the gospel. But first of all, there's bondage. We're in sin. Then secondly, there's deliverance. Then there's a period of time of our wandering, and that just refers to our sojourn here. And then that's the time of our entrance into our land of Canaan, into that land of heaven. And so there's a parallel in a lot of ways between Exodus and between Christianity.
Benny.
Doug, when it speaks about Israel becoming the kingdom of priests, does that apply to all the people or just the priesthood that was...
Well, I understood, are you talking about just the descendants of Aaron, the Levitical priesthood?
Well, he said, "I will make you a kingdom of priests."
I understand that in a sense to refer to the whole nation, mm-hmm. instead of just the particular family priest at that point.
So how were the others priests?
Well, they served as priests in the sense that priests serve as go-betweens between the people and God, and the nation of Israel would serve as a go-between, in a sense, with all the other nations. That's the way I would understand that.
Does anyone else have a question? Ryan?
I have a comment. I was trying to find the scripture before I talked to you about it, but at some point, and I think it's in Deuteronomy, Moses mentions that it's for these 40 years God led you in the wilderness that he might know what's in your heart, is what the phrase is. And it's not a common statement of it, and that's why I wanted to find it. But I thought that was interesting, talking about what you and James were talking about, the parallels. Because then we, though we've obeyed the gospel, we're not ready to go home. Sometime find out what's in our heart, and ties in also with, seek ye first the kingdom of God. The first things get done. That shows what's in your heart.
Well, when you consider the period of wandering, you know, 600,000 footmen over the age of 20 left Egyptian bondage. They wandered for about 40 years, and out of that number over the age of 20 that left, only two made it into the promised land. You know, I think it's pretty sobering. As far as statistics go, I think it ought to be pretty sobering to us as Christians that once we're baptized and become children of God, we must continue to be faithful the rest of our lives. The majority of the Israelites fell in the desert over the age of 40.
Brian Carter. Ron.
Sorry. First a comment and then two questions. You know, on this hardening process, it's really interesting to me. You know, everybody talks about how it was done. and get into this other question. But you know, God in his wisdom, by this hardening process, he permitted the evangelizing the Egyptian population. In other words, by going through that whole process, he was exposed to the nation of Egypt. And by the time that they left there, they was ready to help him out of there, and there's a lot of people of them. It's kind of interesting to me that you know.
Well, not only was it evangelizing of the Egyptian nation, it was the other nations around
them. Yes.
When they will go into the land of Canaan after this, various peoples will say, we've heard about you. We've heard about what your God did to the Egyptians. So it spread. It accomplished an evangelism, as you said.
And it seems like his original statement to Moses about Pharaoh and his hardening is really a statement in which he was preparing Moses for the resistance that he would receive. So it's actually done in that vein, not the vein it's so often put in. My question is, in going through that, is in your studies of that word hardening and so forth, is there any place in there that kind of went from a passive to an active? In the sense that God hardened him and that God exposed him to these things, and so passively he's hardened because of the way God exposed him, but he reaches the point he's so hardened that basically God says, this is done now, and he does it in active sense. Did you in your studies find anything about that?
No, I didn't find any point where it went from passive to active.
Okay.
I couldn't answer that. I tried to read different views, you know, on how he hardened him. A lot of folks want to fault God in there. I know you've read things like that. That when they read that passage, that's the first thing they see, and they blame God. One fellow said perhaps the way that God hardened his heart was by not putting for him something good. You know, it's not that God personally hardened his heart, but God didn't put for him good decisions that he could make. And so therefore, I guess in a passive way, he hardened his heart. And I don't know that I agree with that, but that was one of the positions of guys to it.
Well, it's pretty evident when you look at the total context, God's not responsible. Mm-hmm. But that was just, in terms of this thing about the kingdom of priests, you know, did they ever actually become, you know, you're using the collective sense and the Israel's, but did they ever become a kingdom of priests in the pregnant sense of that term? In other words, because the way they responded, that they did not want that responsibility in terms of what their response was when Moses went up the mountain. So, yeah. Was that never complete? And actually, it doesn't come complete until we step into the kingdom of Christ and the church.
I don't think they ever fulfilled that.
Yeah.
In the book of Isaiah, it's prophesied that they would, even the Jews would be a light to the world. But they don't really seem to fulfill that either. They didn't fulfill what their mission was. And I forgot to bring this out, but you know, those things that are said in Exodus 19, 5 and 6 are repeated in 1 Peter 2, 9 about the church being a holy nation and kingdom of priests and so forth. And so it finds its fulfillment in the church, what God wanted them to do.
Jimmy Cuddy. Recently, when I was going through the Old Testament, I read some scholars who argued that there were 3 million. I'd always said there was 2 million as well, and
that's
pretty interesting. I know it's very interesting to me, though, that they came up with even more people than that. But would you give the reasons why you prefer the early date of the Exodus?
Okay. The two dates are approximately 1440. Now, some of the material I've got is more specific, trying to make it 1446, but I'm just going to 1440 for approximate date, 1290. The reason for the 1440 date is in 1 Kings 6 and verse 1. The Bible says, in the 480th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel in the month of Zeb, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. That's a chronological figure. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign, which corresponded to 480 years since they came out of bondage. Now, scholars give an approximate date to Solomon's reign as being like 966, the fourth year of his reign. Then if you just add 480 years to it, it takes you back to 1446, approximately 1440. Also in the book of Judges, Jephthah says to this Ammonite king that's threatening them, for 300 years Israel occupied Heshbon, Aror and the surrounding settlements and all the towns along the Arnon, why didn't you retake them during that time? That's Judges 11:26. Now, if Jephthah, you know, lived 100 years or so before Solomon, which he probably did, and Israel had already been in the land 300 years, then you combine to that the 40 years of wandering, and it comes again close to 1440. Now, that's based on internal evidence in the Bible. The second date, 1290, basically comes from archaeological findings. Archaeologists have stated that Bethel, Lachish, and Debir, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Palestine, fell as a result of violent attacks somewhere between 1250 and 1200 B.C. So you add your 40 years on to that, and that would put you down to about 1290. And they've also suggested that in their excavations of Jericho, it was thought that the walls of Jericho fell, at least what they thought were the walls, in about 1400, but they, some of them have changed their findings to think that it's in the 1200s. So really, it's kind of internal biblical evidence against archaeological evidence. The archaeological evidence of these cities they've dug up, they say, seems to be around the mid-1200s. And I just assumed that I would go with the scriptures on this. I didn't see any reason for doubting it. Now, some of these scholars have suggested, well, maybe these aren't quite literal numbers, this 480-year period. They said that in the Bible, a lot of times, numbers symbolize things. And a generation is about 40 years long. And 480 years divided by 40 is 12. And so they thought that the 480-year period was actually just a representation of 12 generations. And so they said, well, if 12 generations weren't quite 40 years long, then you could have this 1290 date right here. But as far as I can understand, I just feel more comfortable with the 1440 date.
And what people have done is tried to argue back from what archaeologists have said, try to argue that back into the scriptures, and I think it's too difficult.
Well, you know, it's not an exact science. And they're saying maybe these things were around 1250, but you know, how could they know for sure as far as exact years?
On the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, I studied that in Romans 9, you know, and one interesting thing about that, to me anyway, was that the hardening of Pharaoh's heart is mentioned 19 times in the book of Exodus. And I believe, if my memory serves me right, it indicates that 10 times God hardened his heart, 9 times he hardened his own heart. And then over in the book of Kings, there's another reference to it. Some nation recalls that having happened, and they recall it as Pharaoh hardening his heart. So it said 10 times that God hardened his heart, and 10 times Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And that's pretty interesting that that's balanced like that. And however, God didn't start hardening Pharaoh's heart, or at least it's not said that God did it, until Pharaoh hardened his own 3 or 4 times. I'm not sure. 3, I think. And that's where it looks to me like it changes from the idea of passive to active. Although, when it is active, God is simply continuing to reveal himself to Pharaoh through those miracles. He always had the choice to accept and obey, and he never did do it, or at least he had that choice for a time. And through hardening process, he gradually lost it. But I wanted to ask you, in Exodus 20 on the Ten Commandments, and it talks about remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. And then in Genesis 2 verse 3, where God rested on the Sabbath day and hallowed it and so on. Is it possible that in Genesis 2:3, that is a comment from Moses? I mean, Moses writing this later is commenting on that, and that was not actually said at that time.
Well, when Moses wrote these books, we don't know the exact time that he wrote, but you know, I would maybe this assumption, but I would assume he wrote them during a time of the wandering in the wilderness. And when he wrote at the time, the Sabbath was in existence. And like you say, when he adds, "And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy," he said this just by way of saying it. Not that at that point God blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy, like the Sabbatarians wanted to, that God sanctified it at the creation, and it was binding from that point on for all people. There are two other passages, one in Ezekiel and one in Nehemiah, that indicates that God first gave the Sabbath to the Israelites in the desert. So it wasn't something that he gave to people. If God did sanctify the Sabbath at creation, if he did it, I'm saying if, he didn't reveal it until the desert.
Brother Morris.
What God does about Pharaoh hardens his heart. Jesus said, I came not to send peace with the sword. What that is a result from the teaching. The only way that God hardened Pharaoh's heart was in his, what his teaching is and so forth, that hardened his heart. And it could be said that God hardened his heart, but not in the sense that we're taking that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. It was a result of the teaching. And that's also, to we that are Christians, this is life. To the sinner, it's death. What's taught here, the sinner is dead. But God didn't make that sinner choose that death. See? And he doesn't make us choose that. So it's free will there. And when it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, it's only in the sense that what he was teaching his children to do and what Pharaoh was doing, as a result of that, what God had done hardened his heart, but not in the sense that God did that set apart from Pharaoh.
I think that we've all seen people that we've studied with before, maybe people that aren't faithful. And you try to present the truth to them and they just reject it. And in the process, they just harden their heart against you. You presented the truth to them, and they just reject it. And in that sense, they harden their heart. And I guess the truth has hardened their heart because they won't accept it.
Okay, we have two more on the list. If anyone else has a burning question, we'll take it. Otherwise, after these two, we'll cut it off. John Spradley.
Doug, it's my understanding that God will have mercy on whom whosoever he will, and that whosoever he will, he harmed. We know that he'll be merciful to those who are merciful, but do you have any evidence anywhere in the scriptures that God ever hardened a righteous man's heart?
I can't think of one.
I don't know. And I don't believe he will.
Well, Pharaoh started down that path first. He started down the path of disobedience and rejection. And God just allowed him to continue to do so. God didn't go down that path.
Okay, Brandon?
I don't want to beat the topic to death, but that's really right. And Edwin, everything that's been said is correct in the sense that God didn't change anything he was doing. He just kept sending plagues. And it was the very thing that God was doing that was making Pharaoh just madder and madder. Just like you said, if you're talking to Jehovah's Witness at the door, at first, you know, they're having to close themselves off to what you're saying because they can't answer what you're saying. So they're closing themselves off. They're hardening themselves into a shell. You know, then you keep raising other issues from the scriptures and more issues from the scriptures, and it just makes them madder and madder. And they just get madder and madder and madder. No matter how humble or whatever you might be, no matter how merciful you might be to them, they just get madder and madder and madder. And you can say, it can be said that you are hardening their heart through continuing to teach them, but it's nothing supernatural or against their free will. And the issue is important because it involves man's free will, and that's what's always attacked in religion today, is that man has or has not free will. So these are all really important comments, and it's an important issue.
Alan, did you have another comment?
I just wanted to address that passage that
go ahead.
Brother Spratt mentioned that. In Romans 9, it says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will pardon whom I will pardon. I have to keep in mind that God is not capricious. He doesn't have mercy on people out of a whim, and he doesn't pardon people on a whim because he likes them or he doesn't like them. He has mercy. He's the one who decides when he will have mercy or when he will harden. But the basis on which he decides is righteous, and it has to do with the revelation that's been given. And that was the case of Pharaoh, and that's the case of someone else.
I'd like to make it just a comment and then ask a question of the audience on this as well. And the comment deals with the Red Sea. It wasn't asked during the question and answer, but a lot of times folks have said, doesn't the Red Sea translate into the Sea of Reeds? And therefore, doesn't that mean this wasn't the Red Sea, but it was some other body of water, and it wasn't very deep? And this, of course, comes from the critics, you know, that deny the supernatural. But in looking at that, and it's true that the Red Sea can be translated Sea of Reeds, but it can also be translated Sea of Weeds as well. But what was interesting is in 1 Kings chapter 9, it mentions that Solomon kept the naval fleet at the Red Sea. Now, if we're going to argue that the Red Sea should be translated Sea of Reeds, and it refers only to a body of water that's very shallow, then logically, how could Solomon keep a fleet of ships at the Reed Sea with very little water? Now, the question I have, and this is for someone who might want to answer this, it may be a study. I have wondered how Pharaoh's magicians were able to perform the two miracles, obviously, or through trickery, whatever they did. Do you remember that they were able to change staff into snakes, and they were able to change water into blood, apparently? Now, I wondered if anybody had any good answer on that, whether it was just through magic, through trickery, or whether this was demonic power that they were allowed to have.
Mike, this is just my thought, so you can throw it out. My thought with that is ultimately who was glorified when their snakes were consumed. I've always taken it for granted that was just another way that God used those sorcerers to glorify his name above the Egyptians.
In regards to that, the magicians were able to, I believe, wasn't it the first four plagues that they were able to mimic?
I think it's first two. It was on the third, and they couldn't change the dust and the lights.
I think that sort of parallel with so plain miracles today. There are some things that human beings can do and maybe be assisted by the devil in some of those instances. They can mimic the real miracles that were performed even in the New Testament up to a point, and then they stop. They can't go any further than that. And that's why even today you have just special things that are mentioned, the so-called miracle workers are able to do. So the devil working with people or people through their own magician can just go so far, but then God can just keep going.
Yeah. That's a good point. What was interesting on that is the first miracle, well, changing the staff into serpents, and they were able somehow to change water, what looked like into blood, and then the frogs. But when it came to changing the dust into lights, they couldn't do that. You see, that involved the truly miraculous. They might have deceived people somehow in those first three, but they couldn't deceive them changing an inanimate object into something that had life. They couldn't do that.
Naturalist, of course, they try to take all the miracles and make them naturals, but they seem to be good on Pharaoh. They said that the magicians invoked a form of paralysis in real snakes, and they made them rigid, and then they would, like a chiropractor on them, you know, snap them back into real life or something. But no, that's what I really read, that they knew how to do that. They knew how to make and induce a form of paralysis, and that make them appear as sticks when in reality they were snakes. But anyway,
I read something like that too. One of the commentators was suggesting something along the line. One of them suggested that the Hebrew word for serpent can also be translated crocodile. And he thought these were crocodiles instead of snakes.
Okay, Doug, do you have a closing comment?
The only thing that I would say in closing is what I said at the very beginning, and that is we ought to study individual books of the Bible in reference to their place in the Messianic program. And when we do, that makes, I think, makes the whole Bible come alive. The whole Bible is picturing one wonderful great event, and that's our redemption from sin.
Thank you, Doug.